Labour's GOP Senate primary, from campaigning on promises to drain the swamp and take on the radical left. And although J.D. Vance has said Ohio's elections are pretty gold standard, some of his opponents wanted an audit of the votes cast in the 2020 presidential race. In North Carolina's GOP Senate primary, Donald Trump's backing of Representative Ted Budd wasn't enough to persuade former Congressman Mark Walker to drop out of the race, despite Trump's criticism of him. Mark Walker, a self-described conservative champion who was endorsed by Donald Trump allies Mike Huckabee and Madison Cawthorn, who lost his House seat in North Carolina on Tuesday, was competing with Budd for the most conservative pro-Trump voters in North Carolina. "All right, we got to get Walker out of that race," Donald Trump told North Carolina GOP chairman Michael Whatley at a donor dinner in March. "Get him out of the race, Michael, right?" But no MAGA candidate proved to be as much of a threat to Donald Trump's pick than conservative commentator Kathy Barnett, who gained late momentum in one of the most expensive and most watched primaries of the midterm cycle, and who has said that "Make America Great Again" does not belong to President Trump, although he coined the word MAGA actually belongs to the people, she said, at a recent debate before Pennsylvania's GOP Senate primary. Kathy Barnett added, "Our values never shifted to President Trump's values. It was President Trump who shifted and aligned with our values." On Tuesday, Kathy Barnett, who has been described as ultra-MAGA by right-wing strategist Steve Bannon, came in third behind frontrunners Mehmet Oz and David McCormick in the tight race whose winner was still not known by early Wednesday afternoon. Days leading up to the election, Kathy Barnett barreled ahead despite spending just over 1% of what Mehmet Oz and David McCormick had shelled out on television advertisements. But it wasn't the amount of money that Barnett spent on her campaign that made her an unlikely challenger to Donald Trump and his list of endorsements. Notably, the far-right candidate was publicly opposed by Donald Trump, who had endorsed Mehmet Oz, a more moderate candidate. Kathy Barnett will never be able to win the general election against the radical left Democrats, Donald Trump said last week. Trump added, "Dr. Oz is the only one who will be able to easily defeat the crazed lunatic Democrat in Pennsylvania. A vote for anyone else in the primary is a vote against victory in the fall." Many analysts think Pennsylvania Senate candidate Kathy Barnett's rise among GOP voters without a Trump endorsement could bode well for other Republican politicians, politicians like Florida Governor Ron DeSantis. Before Tuesday's voting, Republican strategist Jay Townsend told Newsweek, "It is ironic that Donald Trump has endorsed the moderate in the Pennsylvania Senate race rather than the ultra-MAGA." He added that Kathy Barnett's rise during the campaign could be an indication that Trump is losing a grip on the cult that he created. Although Kathy Barnett's performance could be troubling for Trump, it may bode well for another prominent Republican, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, who is emerging as a leading contender for the GOP's presidential nomination in 2024. Ron DeSantis, whose political success Trump has taken credit for, has become critical of the former president in recent months over things like Trump's early handling of the coronavirus pandemic. And while the Republican has been careful to not completely abandon Trump, Kathy Barnett's strong showing during the campaign suggests that candidates courting "Make America Great Again" voters no longer have to secure a Donald Trump endorsement in order to win, a shift Florida's governor is likely to embrace. Ron DeSantis is not refuting Donald Trump, Trumpism or the America First policies. DeSantis is actually positioning himself as the next step, the iteration, GOP strategist Alex Patton told Newsweek. The competition playing out right now isn't about ideas or policies. It is about political power and who will wield it. That tactic is why Ron DeSantis hasn't made any endorsements outside his home state, Patton noted. He's smart, sitting back, not challenging Trump directly, and allowing Trump to willfully take the slings and arrows of this cycle, he said. Some Republicans have been hopeful that a potential Donald Trump-Ron DeSantis ticket could excite voters in huge numbers, but the governor's growing popularity across the country might be enough to convince him to seek the White House for himself. Without officially throwing their hat in the ring, both Republicans have teased a presidential bid. Townsend predicts that at this rate, Trump and DeSantis are likely on a collision course heading towards 2024. Townsend suspects the governor is likely welcoming Kathy Barnett's showing in Pennsylvania as proof that Donald Trump's power is beginning to wane. Patton agrees, saying, when everyone is bloody and tired of the fighting, Ron DeSantis is positioned to swoop in and save the day. The governor has suggested he's waiting for a big re-election win this year before he makes any decision on a presidential bid. Asked about his White House ambitions earlier this month, Ron DeSantis told podcaster Lisa Booth, my goal would be, if we win the election really big, people like you who analyze these things are going to say, the days of Florida being a swing state are over. Florida is a red state. He added, I think that's because of a lot of what we've done.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Elena Duhan, the United Nations Special Rapporteur on the negative impact of unilateral coercive measures on the enjoyment of human rights, who was on a mission to Iran from May 7th to 18th, has described U.S. sanctions on Iran as unjustifiable and inhumane.
Iran has been subjected to a broad scope of unilateral sanctions for a long period of time already. In particular, the United States has imposed economic, trade, and financial sanctions on Iran since the late 1970s, with a comprehensive trade ban since 1995, and measures to isolate Iran from the international commercial and financial system. These were expanded in mid-2000 and again after 2010, extending to many economic sectors.
U.S. sanctions also targeted Iran's central bank as well as commercial banks. The EU adopted restrictive measures and comprehensive economic and trade sanctions against Iran in 2010, supplemented by an oil embargo in 2012, and trade prohibitions involving key sectors and the freezing of assets of the Iranian Central Bank, Iranian shipping and shipbuilding sector, and a number of persons and entities, and restrictions on financial services, as well as exports and imports. In May 2018, Washington unilaterally withdrew from the JCPOA, under which the international sanctions on the Islamic Republic were eased in exchange for Tehran putting limitations on certain aspects of its nuclear activities. The U.S. then reinstated harsh economic sanctions on Iran and slapped new ones that barred countries and international firms from working with Tehran. Duhan said, the U.S. continues to ban trade and investment in Iran, forcing foreign companies to leave the country for the fear of sanctions. Many banks and businesses, including pharmaceutical and medical companies around the world, overcomply with sanctions out of fear of potential penalties. The UN rapporteur stated that overcompliance with U.S. sanctions could strip Iranians of their basic rights to health. The top UN human rights official highlighted that applying extraterritorial sanctions on Iranian companies or companies working with Iran is illegal under international law. Duhan added that the sanctions have also hampered Iran's effort to import life-saving medicines due to restrictions on banking transactions.
Human rights in Iran are severely affected by the use of unilateral sanctions. The most close to every single individual's fear is the fear of health. The situation in Iran is the following, that some medicine are produced domestically. At the same time, the raw materials are imported. And then it comes the issue again of payments, deliveries, the quality of delivered raw materials. When it comes to the rare or severe diseases, there is no possibility to deliver that.
Commenting on Iran's frozen assets abroad, the UN official said the assets estimated to be around $120 billion need to be unblocked. Duhan began her 11-day visit to Iran on May 7th, a day before the fourth anniversary of the U.S. illegal withdrawal from the JCPOA. She also referred to stalled negotiations in Vienna to bring the U.S. back to the JCPOA, urging the signatories and the U.S. to resume the negotiations. In the end, Duhan called on sanctioning states, the U.S. in particular, to abandon their policy of maximum pressure against Iran and other countries. Economic sanctions are the policy tool of choice for the United States to force countries to bend if they don't follow Washington's foreign policy objectives in many cases. Yet they have failed to bring the desired result, as they might generate some meaningful behavioral change in the targeted or sanctioned country about 40% of time.
We know that sanctions really don't work as far as convincing or having leaderships of different countries change their decision making or their behavior. So I think over the years we've learned that nothing's going to change with the continued sanctions.
Unilateral sanctions have endangered the humanitarian situation and people's livelihood in Iran, while further affecting the vulnerable strata of the society. In sanctioned countries like Iran, Venezuela, Cuba, Syria, and Yemen, medical equipment is rather outdated, and they suffer shortages of medicine and protective means. One of the reasons is that payment systems are not available to buy and have medicine enter the respective countries. For instance, Iran was the scene of a serious economic and health crisis, hit hard by the coronavirus pandemic. The embargo put in place by the United States threatened the lives of many Iranians. In what has been termed economic terrorism, Washington attempts to use sanctions as a leverage to overthrow the legitimate governments of other countries, something it has done in the case of Venezuela and Cuba. Whether direct or indirect, most of the U.S. sanctions are not authorized by the United Nations Security Council, and many of them are imposed unilaterally by Washington. In fact, more than two-thirds of the world's countries officially condemn U.S. sanctions as a blatant violation of international law and the UN Charter.
On Thursday, leaders of Sweden and Finland, two European nations that opted for neutrality for years, flanked U.S. President Joe Biden while he threw his support behind their bid to join the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO, at the White House.
And today I'm proud to assure them that they have the full, total, complete backing of the United States of America. Today, my administration is submitting to the United States Congress reports on NATO accession for both countries so the Senate can efficiently and quickly move on advising and consenting to the treaty.
So I don't think those nations really ought to be scared of Russia. That would be really stupid if they were. Maybe they are that foolish and believe the narrative going on. I think it's more there's a power play. I mean, you look at the sanctions, that's where you really see the intent. And President Biden said this in Poland. He said, we intend that Russia's economy will be half of what it was over years. So that reveals he's planning to continue this for years. Zelensky, even if he were inclined to negotiate, will not be allowed to do it. And I think there's an intent to force governments to pick sides.
The move comes amid objections by Turkey, a NATO ally, and warnings by Russia. Ankara opposes Finland's and Sweden's accession to the military alliance, citing their longtime support for groups Turkey deems terrorists. Moscow, however, has warned of retaliation if Finland, a country that shares a 1,340-kilometer-long border with Russia, joins NATO. Russia's Deputy UN Representative Dmitry Polyansky went so far as to say that the two nations could turn into potential targets for Russia if they become NATO members. Finland and Sweden say they decided to join the NATO and reverse decades of military non-alignment after Russia attacked Ukraine. But Russia considers NATO's eastward expansion a threat to its national security. The issue was a critical reason Russian officials say pushed Moscow to launch its military operation in Ukraine in February. As the war between Ukraine and Russia entered its fourth month, the U.S. Senate passed a $40 billion bill to provide assistance to Ukraine. 86 senators voted for the bill, while 11 others, all Republicans, voted against it, citing its high price tag and the fact that it might not be offset. The bill earmarks $6 billion for arms to be purchased from contractors and sent to Ukraine. It also increases the presidential drawdown capacity from the $5 billion the Biden administration had originally requested to $11 billion. The drawdown capacity allows the president to send away arms and military equipment directly from U.S. stocks at times of emergency.
It used to be the case when you had votes for sanctions against Russia, it would only be two senators voting against. So I think the revolt against this policy is growing. And I can tell you from the campaigning I've been doing and speaking with hundreds of American voters, Americans do not want this war. They don't support spending all this money on weapons. They may not have a completely elevated view of it, but their inclination is to say, we are suffering here. We're paying $1 million a gallon for gasoline. We're running out of baby formula. Why are we doing this? And I want that to be known around the world that the American people are not represented by the policies of this administration.
The war and the subsequent sanctions on Russia have sent shockwaves across the globe, threatening the most vulnerable economies in the world that have yet to recover from the economic fallout of the COVID-19 pandemic. It's also creating a new global crisis, food shortages.
This is not just about Ukraine. This is about the poorest of the poor around the world who are on the brink of starvation as we speak.
The whole world, including the U.S. and its allies, is paying the price for the war and its ensuing events. The situation would only get worse if the conflict continues indefinitely. The economic, political, and military pressures against Moscow don't seem to contribute to any compromise from the Russian side. The U.S. has expressed its opposition to a prolonged war, but actions speak louder than words.
Tensions between Russia and Israel appear to be on the rise. Israeli media reports say Russian forces have opened fire on Israeli jets with advanced S-300 anti-aircraft missiles. The missiles were fired at Israeli warplanes after they attacked targets in northwestern Syria. The move is seen as a sign of significant shift in Moscow's attitude toward Israel. The unprecedented incident is said to have occurred on Friday night when Israeli jets targeted an area near the city of Masyaf, which killed several people. Israel's airstrikes on targets in Syria are countered by the country's anti-aircraft missile batteries. But this time, however, the S-300 batteries also opened fire as the jets were departing the area.
It is the case that these missiles, the S-300 battery, is operated by Russian military personnel, and that they would not have fired without permission from senior commanders. Okay, this is a break in the normal procedure.
Syria's S-300 batteries are operated by Russian military and cannot be fired without their approval. Israeli media reports claim the S-300 radar did not manage to lock onto the Israeli jets and thus did not present a serious threat to the fighter jets. But this would mark the first use of the S-300s against the Israeli warplanes over Syria. It's not clear whether the S-300 missile fire was a one-time event or if it was a Russian signal to Israel that it was changing its policy.
So this was the first use of it, and it was known to be done by Russian military personnel at Russian military command. But it also, they did not lock the radar on the planes. So the planes were never in danger. It's unclear from the reports whether they couldn't lock the radar on the planes or whether they just didn't lock them and just wanted to throw these missiles up there as a kind of signal and a warning to Israel that, you know, we may change our policy and we may take down some planes.
The development comes amid deteriorating relations between Tel Aviv and Moscow over Ukraine. Israel has backed Ukraine after the war began. Tel Aviv's stance has angered Russia. Russia's latest move against Israel would be a worrying development for Israel.
And that has to do, of course, with the whole reverberations of what's going on with Ukraine. And, you know, the Russians are realizing that and starting to act much more militantly, in the sense that they understand this is now a war for the future of a lot of things.
The Tel Aviv regime has repeatedly targeted the positions of the Syrian army and its allies, but has rarely acknowledged or discussed such operations. The aerial bombardment intensified in scale and frequency after 2011, when the Arab country found itself in the grip of foreign-backed militancy and terrorism.
Oh, it will continue. No question about it. Look, it's not going to even think about stopping until a plane goes down. If S-300s or some other effective anti-aircraft defense takes down Israeli planes, then there'll be a problem. So the Russians have signaled something here, and they didn't take down a plane. And until and unless they do, Israel's not going to change its policy on that at all. And even if they do, that would cause a problem for Israel, and they would have to think twice about it.
Damascus says Tel Aviv carries out attacks on the Arab country to aid terrorist groups against the Syrian army. It has repeatedly complained to the United Nations, calling the aggression a blatant violation of the country's sovereignty and international law. The development comes after warmongering rhetoric of Israeli officials against Iran and its allies. Just recently, Israel's Minister of Military Affairs, Benny Gantz, said Tel Aviv would prevent Iran from transferring advanced capabilities to its allies in the region. But Iran has dismissed the threat, saying it's determined to help the resistance axis stand up against Israel's aggressive moves in the region.
Former U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has visited Albania. Officially, the trip was meant to celebrate the centenary of U.S.-Albania diplomatic relations. But Pompeo's stance against Iran manifested itself after he went to the camp of a notorious terrorist cult there. Pompeo held a meeting with the leaders of the Mujahideen-e Khalq, or MKO, terrorist cult. Encouraged by the presence of terrorists there, Pompeo repeated his anti-Iran rant, expressing his long unfulfilled wish to see the Islamic Republic overthrown. The former CIA chief said that under the leadership of infamous Maryam Rajavi, the MKO has been laying the groundwork for what he called a, quote, free, sovereign, democratic republic of Iran.
The recent visit of Mike Pompeo to Albania is in a way a revitalization of the old connections that Mike Pompeo has with Israeli Mossad and the Iranian Mujahideens, who are terrorists.
Pompeo is not part of the current U.S. administration, but his rhetoric and deeds indeed reflect the deep-seated animosity of the U.S. establishment towards Iran and its government. During his tenure as the U.S. Secretary of State between 2018 and 2021 in the Trump administration, Pompeo and other belligerent politicians around him, most notably former National Security Advisor John Bolton, expressed an open secret regarding Washington's stance towards MKO terrorist cult. Pompeo and his team became the MKO sponsors in his delusional attempt to overthrow the Islamic Republic. Back then, the regime in Washington left no stone unturned to topple Iran, but failed miserably in their hysteric anti-Iran drive.
Pompeo was paid probably more than $150,000 for his visit to the Mujahideen camp.
Mujahideen e Khalq is a terrorist cult which is now based at a camp in Albania. The MKO regularly hosts big events in which top American and European officials make speeches in support of the group.
They run a paramilitary camp in the town of Manza in the region of Durrës in Albania. From Manza, the Mujahideens, they carry hostile and terrorist activities against Iran, but even against political Islam in general.
Former U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton, former U.S. Senator Joe Lieberman, and former Director of Saudi Arabia's intelligence agency, Turki bin Faisal Al Saud, are amongst the top officials that have attended the group's events. The terrorist cult has been accused of being involved in various criminal activities in Europe, including human trafficking, with possible links to the Daesh Takfiri terrorist group. The MKO was formally designated as a terrorist group around the world, but the United States and the Europeans delisted it in recent years amid growing strains in ties with Tehran. The terrorist group also fought alongside Iraqi forces in the former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein's war on Iran in the 1980s. Prior to that, it killed thousands of ordinary Iranians and officials, the number said to be in the tens of thousands. Support for anti-Iran terrorist groups in the US and Europe has remarkably grown in the Western countries, with many Western spy agencies actively involved in aiding and arming them.
Well, the U.S. government has a long history of cooperating with terrorist organizations. Nowadays, we have many countries in the Middle East who complain from the U.S. support for different terrorist groups.
The Islamic Republic has already warned Europeans that their support for the MKO will be costly for them. Tehran has condemned the hosting of the group by Albania and is delisting by the U.S. and Europe.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
A study by Kelton Miner at the University of Copenhagen in Denmark analyzed sleep and outdoor weather data collected from 2015 to 2017 and found that higher world temperatures reduce sleep by delaying its onset. People's bodies need to cool every night as they fall asleep, but this is harder when it is warmer. We now present you an article written by Damien Carrington. The piece is titled Study Finds Global Heating is Cutting Sleep Across the World. The largest study to date has found rising temperatures driven by the climate crisis are cutting the sleep of people across the world. Good sleep is critical to health and well-being. But global heating is increasing nighttime temperatures even faster than in the daytime, making it harder to sleep at night. The analysis revealed that the average global citizen is already losing 44 hours of sleep a year, leading to 11 nights with less than 7 hours sleep, a standard benchmark of sufficient sleep. Lost sleep will increase further as the planet continues to heat, but it affects some groups much more than others. The sleep loss per degree of warming is about a quarter higher for women than men, twice as high for those over the age of 65, and three times higher for those in less affluent nations. The researchers used data from sleep tracking wristbands used by 47,000 people over 7 million nights and across 68 countries. Previous studies have shown that rising temperatures damage health, including increased heart attacks, increased suicides and mental health crises, and accidents and injuries, as well as reducing the ability to work. Poor sleep has also been shown to have these effects, and the researchers said their study suggests that disturbed sleep may be a key mechanism by which heat causes these health impacts. Worryingly, the researchers said their data showed no sign of people being able to adapt to hotter nights. Kelton Miner at the University of Copenhagen in Denmark, who led the new research, said, "For most of us, sleep is a familiar part of our daily routine. We spent nearly a third of our lives asleep." Kelton Miner added, "But growing numbers of people in many countries across the world do not sleep enough." He said, "In this new study, we provide the first planetary scale evidence that warmer than average temperatures erode human sleep. It might actually be the tip of the iceberg because it's very likely our estimates are conservative." Kelton Miner from the University of Copenhagen said sleep reduced by warmer nights is affecting huge numbers of people. For example, he said, a night above 25 degrees Celsius in a city of 1 million people would result in 46,000 extra people suffering from shorter sleep. Kelton Miner said, and if you look at the heat wave that's transpiring right now in India and Pakistan, we're talking about billions of individuals exposed to conditions expected to result in considerable sleep loss. The new study, published in the journal One Earth, analyzed sleep and outdoor weather data collected from 2015 to 2017. And found that higher temperatures reduce sleep by delaying its onset. People's bodies need to cool down every night as they fall asleep, but this is harder to do when it is warmer. Women may be affected more because their bodies usually cool faster than men's when going to sleep. Women also have higher levels of subcutaneous fat on average, making cooling slower. Older people are known to sleep less at night and have poorer body temperature regulation, which may explain their susceptibility. People in poorer nations could lose more sleep as they have less access to cooling features such as window shutters, fans and air conditioning. Researchers at the University of Copenhagen found the impact of warmer nights on sleep was seen in all countries, whether they had naturally cooler or warmer climates, with the impact clear when nighttime temperatures rose above 10 degrees Celsius. Kelton Miner said, "Worryingly, we also found evidence that people already living in warmer climates experience greater sleep erosion per degree of temperature rise." He added, "We had expected those individuals to be better adapted. Furthermore, according to the data, people did not catch up on missed sleep at later times." Kelton Miner said the research had important implications for policymakers, who needed to ensure cities, towns and buildings were well adapted to heat in order to reduce the health impact of rising global temperatures. The British government's official advisers warned in 2021 that it was failing to protect people from the fast-rising risks of the climate crisis, particularly heat waves. The data used in the new study came mainly from richer nations, although it included some data from India, China, Colombia, and South Africa. The wristbands also tended to be worn by people less prone to sleep disturbance by warmer temperatures, such as middle-aged, wealthier men. Kelton Miner said, "Lower-income people are underrepresented in the data, and we're very transparent about that." He said further research was needed, particularly in places that already ranked as among the hottest in the world, such as large parts of Africa, Central America, and West Asia. The research was unable to assess sleep quality, such as the different phases of sleep, but there was no change in the number of times people woke up in the night. Kelton Miner said the path the world chose in terms of how hot the planet got would have consequences for everyone's sleep, adding, "Our decisions collectively as societies will have costs in terms of sleep."
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Deep insight and firm determination, the most outstanding qualities of Hazrat Hamza. On January 25, 2022, Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, met with the officials of Hazrat Hamza International Conference. This is a part of his speech with the managers of this conference. In the name of God, the Beneficent, the Merciful, all praise is due to God, the Lord of the worlds, and peace and greetings be upon our Master Muhammad and upon his pure household, and may God curse all their enemies. I thank you very much, honorable gentlemen, for thinking of this endeavor and taking this great step. Of course, this is just a preliminary step. This means that your action and this commemoration of Hamza, greetings be upon him, is groundwork for future endeavors. the main work must be done by art, and the performing arts, linguistic and visual arts must be used in order to achieve the purpose of honoring and commemorating a personality like Hamza. Otherwise, the mere act of organizing commemoration ceremonies will not serve the purpose just because it will be broadcast in the media and just because the name of that personality will be mentioned there for a certain period of time. The task that you want to carry out, creating a culture and presenting role models, cannot be done except with artistic work, and it will remain incomplete if artistic methods are not used. Therefore, what you are doing is very good.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
As you pointed out, you must rely on precision and improve quality as much as you can. This will help those who are doing artistic work to have the necessary resources and documentations at their disposal. Now, I wish to raise a few points about Hazrat Hamza. He is really one of the lesser-known companions of the Messenger of God. Greetings be upon him and his household. Despite the role that he played when he announced his faith, the way that he announced his faith was really astonishing as well. He publicly shouted that he had become a Muslim after having heavily beaten Abu Jahl, cited by Ibn Athir. Ibn Athir says this in Usdul Ghaba, the lions of the forest. This was his manner of faith, and as for emigration to Medina, in that glorious Islamic fortress that the Holy Prophet wanted to build in that small environment, his presence was very effective. According to one narration too, the first Sariya, that is the small army that the Holy Prophet dispatched without his own presence, that the Holy Prophet dispatched was led by Hazrat Hamza. He gave him a banner and sent him to battle. His role was also outstanding in the Battle of Badr.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
In the limelight.
Just over a month into year three of the COVID-19 pandemic, research revealed recently that life expectancy in the United States declined again in 2021. Stay with us for an article in this regard written by Jessica Corbett, journalist. This article is published under the heading Drop in Life Expectancy Speaks Volumes About How U.S. Handled COVID, expert says. Here's the details. Just over a month into year three of the COVID-19 pandemic, research revealed recently that life expectancy in the United States declined again in 2021, which followed a well-documented drop in 2020 and contrasted a recovery trend in other high-income countries. The paper, which has not yet been peer-reviewed, shows that U.S. life expectancy fell from 78.86 years in 2019 to 76.99 years in 2020 and 76.60 years in 2021, a net loss of 2.26 years. The study comes as progressives in Congress continue to fight for Medicare for All legislation to replace the U.S. for-profit healthcare system, one in which 112 million adults struggle to afford care, according to Gallup and Wealth Health. The research also comes just days after a Poor People's Campaign analysis exposed how the public health crisis was twice as deadly in poor countries as in healthy ones and exacerbated pre-existing social and economic disparities that have long festered in the United States. Johns Hopkins University's case tracker reported that recently, COVID-19 had claimed 984,571 lives across the United States of America, or nearly 16% of the more than 6 million deaths globally. Dr. Stephen Wolf, co-author of the new study and director emeritus of the Center on Society and Health at Virginia Commonwealth University, said in a statement that we already knew that the U.S. experienced historic losses in life expectancy in 2020 due to the COVID-19 pandemic. What wasn't clear is what happened in 2021. Early in 2021, knowing an excellent vaccine was being distributed, I was hopeful that the U.S. could recover some of its historic losses, said Wolf, adding, but I began to worry more when I saw what happened as the year unfolded. He said, even so, as a scientist, until I saw the data, it remained an open question how U.S. life expectancy for that year would be affected. It was shocking to see that U.S. life expectancy, rather than having rebounded, had dropped even further. In addition to examining the United States, the researchers looked at life expectancy over the past 2 years in 19 peer countries and found a smaller drop between 2019 and 2020, an average of 57/10 years, followed by an average 28/10 year increase from 2020 to 2021. While other high-income countries saw their life expectancy increase in 2021, recovering about half of their losses, U.S. life expectancy continued to fall, Wolf said, adding, this speaks volumes about the life consequences of how the U.S. handled the pandemic. taking aim at policymakers who opposed efforts to curb the spread of the virus. The expert added that in a country where U.S. Constitution and 10th Amendment grant public health authority to the states, I believe the U.S. catastrophe speaks volumes about the policies and behaviors of U.S. governors, at least some of them. A highly effective vaccine was available in 2021 that made COVID-19 deaths almost completely preventable. Wolf highlighted that while the Delta and Omicron variants significantly contributed to the death toll in the United States, those mutations also impacted other countries that saw life expectancy rates rebound last year. He said deaths from these variants occurred almost entirely among unvaccinated people. What happened in the U.S. is less about the variants than the levels of resistance to vaccination and the public's rejection of practices such as masking and mandates to reduce viral transmission. Noting high rates of heart disease and obesity, as well as inequities in access to healthcare in the United States, lead author and University of Colorado Boulder sociology professor Ryan Master said that those same factors made the U.S. more vulnerable than other countries to the mortality consequences of COVID-19. The study states that over a two-year period between 2019 and 2021, U.S. Hispanic and non-Hispanic black populations experienced the largest losses in life expectancy, reflecting the legacy of systematic racism and inadequacies in the U.S. handling of the pandemic. Wolf said that sadly, it was not a surprise to see the disproportionate impact on people of color. Our research had shown previously, but there was an interesting plot twist in 2021. The only decrease in life expectancy occurred in white people. Life expectancy in the black population even increased. Despite that increase, he pointed out, life expectancy in the black population remains far lower than in other groups, but the disproportionate impact on white people holds clues to what happened in 2021. Co-author Ladan Aron, a senior fellow at Urban Institute, told The Washington Post, "It's hard to imagine that willingness to be vaccinated is not a piece of that puzzle. The life expectancy gap between the United States and its peer income countries is now over 5 years, which is an incredible gap," she said. Death and life expectancy? That's the ultimate marker of what it means to live in a country. The new research comes after a March study published in the journal Population and Development Review, which found that global life expectancy appears to have declined by 92 tenths years between 2019 and 2020, and by another 72 tenths years between 2020 and 2021. Changes in life expectancy between 2019 and 2020 in America, Europe, and a few other countries have received copious attention.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Hundreds of Palestinians attended a national conference in the blockaded Gaza Strip to mark the first anniversary of the victory of Palestinian resistance against the Israeli regime in the Sword of Al-Quds battle. The Gaza-based resistance groups, mainly Hamas and the Islamic Jihad, fired more than 4,000 rockets towards the Israeli-occupied territories during the 11-day war. The Sword of Al-Quds battle began when Hamas's Izzeddin Qassam brigades attacked the Israeli regime in retaliation to Israeli aggressions on Palestinians in Al-Quds Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood. During the battle, Israeli attacks claimed the lives of over 260 Palestinians, including scores of children and women. Addressing the conference via satellite, the head of the Political Bureau of Hamas movement, Ismail Haniyeh, warned the Israeli regime against holding the so-called flag march in Al-Quds.
The Zionist enemy must understand that the Sword of Al-Quds battle will be a walk in the park compared to any future battles with Palestinian resistance groups. The Zionists must not test our patience, and they must stop their provocations, especially in Al-Quds and the Al-Aqsa Mosque.
Palestinians believe that the Sword of Al-Quds battle has united their ranks. During the 11-day war, all Palestinian factions in the Gaza Strip worked together through the Joint Chamber of Military Operations.
During the Sword of Al-Quds battle, Palestinians were united together against the Israeli forces. The Sword of Al-Quds battle exposed the weakness of the Israeli regime. The Palestinian people in Gaza, in Al-Quds, and in the occupied West Bank will always fight for their rights.
Palestinian resistance groups have been holding military maneuvers following the Sword of Al-Quds battle to confront any new Israeli war amid the increasing warmongering rhetoric by the Israeli regime.
Observers say that Palestinian resistance groups fought a fierce battle against the Israeli regime last year, forcing Tel Aviv to declare a unilateral ceasefire. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
French cement giant Lafarge has lost their final appeal and will undergo a high-profile trial in a precedent-setting case which could force Western corporations to stop turning a blind eye to terrorism. Lafarge will be tried for complicity in crimes against humanity in Syria. They are accused of working with Daesh terrorist group for years in northern Syria, with the concrete produced in their factory used in battlefield infrastructure which terrorists needed to keep the unrest going. They will be tried for financing terrorism, for allegedly paying 13 million euros to terrorist groups from 2010 to 2014, supposedly to keep their factories safe. They will also be charged for endangering the lives of others, for putting its 11 Syrian employees at risk. The original suit was brought by French NGO Sherpa on behalf of the workers.
We were surprised by the decision of the Court de Cassation. And this decision is really a victory because we were a bit worried that crimes against humanity would be dropped. But the fact also that on top of that, there is endangering life of workers that has been maintained is really, I mean, a double victory. So we are super happy, even though we have to remember that it's been 6 years.
After the scandal broke, Lafarge was merged with Swiss giant Holcim, but 8 Lafarge executives will now face justice.
It's the first time that a court decided on crimes against humanity, the first time it's on the mother company for the activities of its subsidiary, especially a subsidiary abroad and foreign workers. It's super interesting for access to justice for victims around the globe. And maybe opening, you know, new avenues for the victims of globalization around the world.
Leaked testimony from the Lafarge executives reveals that the French Foreign Ministry knew the entire time, telling Lafarge to hold on and that everything would work out. The case will likely drag on for years, but longtime political heavyweight and former foreign minister Laurent Fabius may be called on to testify. In 2012, he infamously said that al-Nusra, al-Qaeda's affiliate in Syria, was, quote, doing good things on the ground, and likely with Lafarge's concrete. Ramin Mazahari, Paris.
The drama theater of Mariupol. It is the scene of the alleged single most deadly war crime so far in this brutal conflict.